I'll always love you.
Welcome everyone to Xena Newber's podcast, aka XNU. My name is Cass and I will be your pod host. Also, welcome back to those of you who have been following this podcast so far. We're now up to episode number 124. This podcast show is for all the Xena and Uber subtext stories that are out there that have not been given a voice. Hello everyone, welcome back to XNU, and to those new to the show, welcome and sit back, and I hope you enjoy the show. The song snippet for this week's show is Tina Cousins' Pray. Check it out on YouTube. Go ahead and buy the CD. It's an older one, but, you know, I thought it was very good for the show. We've got a few good things going on in the show, so we're going to get right into it, starting off with the song snippets and then moving right along. In the book recommendation this week, over at Boldstroke Books, we've got Wolfsbane Winter by Jane Fletcher. The Iron Wolf mercenaries who guard travelers on the Misery Trail are notorious for their quick and casual sex lives. Darren may fit the stereotype that better than most, but she has her reasons. A childhood tragedy has left her weary of forming attachment. If you don't care, then you can't get hurt, but you can still make a mess of things. Such as the air of judgment that leaves her with no money, forced to spend the winter on a lousy job in a miserable little backwater. There she meets Alana, local healer, vet, and woman of mystery. Does it take Darren long to find out that Alana is more than what she seems, and has her own perilous secret to keep? Yet Darren still finds herself falling for the woman, so much so that her come-and-go lifestyle is at risk. This would be bad enough, but serious trouble arises for Darren and Alana, in the form of demonic magic from the time of chaos, revealing that old legends are not merely material for ghost stories around the fire. As the danger increases, who do they need to fear more, the living or the dead? That's Wolfsbane Winter by Jane Fletcher, and I'll have a link on my show notes for you to go and read it. And then for the movie recommendation, we have an oldie here, and it's called I've Heard the Mermaid Singing. It's from 1987. And the description over at the Internet Movie Database says, scatterbrained Polly gets a job as a secretary in Gabrielle's art gallery. Gabrielle has a romantic relationship with the painter, Mary. Polly hangs a picture of Mary, believing that Gabrielle made it. So that's not really a great synopsis, but that's all we can find. So I'll have a link on my show notes for you to take it a look and see if you want to go and rent it and enjoy it.
You snapped, haven't you?
And the quote for this week comes from Oprah Winfrey. This is, the roses, the lovely notes, the dining and dancing are all welcome and splendid. But when the Godiva is gone, the gift of real love is having someone who'll go the distance with you. Someone who, when the wedding day limo breaks down, is willing to share a seat on the bus.
We interrupt our program to bring you a special broadcast.
And in this week's update of the marathon fundraising, first and foremost, we want to say a great big thank you to all the listeners who have donated. Greatly appreciated. Every single bit counts. You have no idea how much I greatly appreciate it and how much I am moved by all the people who are starting to donate and give $5, $10, $25. It's greatly appreciated. Thank you so, so much, everyone. For those of you who haven't donated yet, please, please find it in your heart. $5, $10, like I said, it's a tall grande latte with volume mocha and everything else considered added to it that you skip for one day, which I don't know, some people might not need to skip that, but I'm going to give you the latest update. I went for a long run on Sunday, this past Sunday, Now for a 13.1 mile, which is equal to 21.75K or something like that. Basically, essentially, I ran a half marathon. And I decided, oh, okay, I'm going to run this course. You know, I mapped it out on the map, and I knew I was familiar with the route. So I said, okay, we'll go this way. Now, one point of realization that what constitutes is a really nice scenic road when you're driving isn't necessarily the same when you're running it, because those undulating hills and the scenic actually becomes mountains and hills of 45 degrees. And they weren't pleasant. And on the first hill that I hit, and it's a 45 degree incline, and I literally had to stop to walk it. I could not get up it. And then you get to the level playing field, so to speak, and you start jogging it through. And then all of a sudden you crest and start coming down the hill. You're like, yeah, I feel great. This is good. I can do this. And me and my infinite Black Knight wisdom, merely a flesh wound, I decided to take this hill, great guns, at 100 knots per second. I pulled a groin muscle. Now, for those of you who have ever experienced this great and pleasurable feeling, not, can I ask how many of you have ever attempted to ice your groin? I don't know about you, but it was never meant to have ice put on it. Not like that! But I could say that it's healed. I didn't pull it as bad as I thought I did. But it's been a great and a wonderful feeling, and I actually made a note comment on one of my other sites, and I turned around and put New Balance running shoes, $200. Skins running tights, $75. Running along on a half marathon and coming halfway to a hill that's 45 degrees with nowhere else to go but up, priceless. For all body abusing attempts, there's Mama Cass. All others are just sitting by watching and laughing. So there's your MasterCard commercial for the week. But this is going great. I am really enjoying it. I was actually quite surprised that I wasn't sore the next day. So that says so much of my S&M tendencies now. I can run that and not be sore. And when I went to my remedial massage therapist and she put her elbows through my calves and thighs and I didn't scream, I whimpered, but I didn't scream. And she says, oh, you're getting used to this. I was like, okay, I need to stop. If I'm getting used to pain, there's something definitely wrong with me. So that's where we're running. That's where we're at. Keep the donations coming in. For those of you who have yet to donate, please go ahead, donate now. For those of you who have, thank you so much. I greatly, greatly am really touched by your sense of support and understanding for this great cause, and that all this suffering and all these pleasurable experiences that I can bring to you are not for naught. So let's get on with the show. We're going to, obviously, we've taken a break from the, just can't stop thinking about the ice where it doesn't need to belong. But we're going to go on with a story that I did a beginning part of on the 100th episode. It was Denny's You Can't Tame a Wild Rose. And we're going to continue on with chapter 2 of that. She's given us an update, and we're going to do that for the next few shows to catch up where she keeps sending me updates. And once again, it's reference back to the 100th episode to listen to the first part. And we continue on with chapter 2 now of You Can't Tame a Wild Rose. Come and get some. You Can't Tame a Wild Rose by Denny. Chapter 2. It was getting dark, and although the young girl had skipped off into the sea of corn, the warrior watched and she could only see the swaying movement of the stalks. Either way, she knew it was time to head back to the encampment. She would have to come back to this farm and find out the name of this child. Without the pretense of lies and death, this child changed her life. Forever. She touched a part of the warrior princess that no other living human had. There was just something about this child, and she had to know more. The reluctance to face Ares slowed her pace. She needed time to think about how to do this without finding herself in Tartarus. Her mind rambled through several layers of thoughts. Ares, Athena, the child, her headache, the soldiers, even the campfires. But nothing seemed to make sense. It was all a blur of Fury's voices. The pounding headache even made it more difficult to concentrate. She knew this had to be handled with the most delicate hand. If not done right, she would find herself without a patron or any protection. She needed help, guide and strength to follow through and intelligence with military-like strategy. She had to do this perfectly, and the only god or goddess that she knew of who could help her would be Athena, as she is known as the warrior goddess. She isn't the female version of Ares, who would act and react without thought or planning. Athena does it with clever preparation, reasoning, and wisdom. Athena keeps ahead while never losing sight of the ultimate objective. Although she is fierce and brave in battle, she only goes to war to defend the home as a last resort, and always seems to be on the winning side. So any fight between Ares and Athena, Ares would always lose. Ares, on the other hand, is rash, quick-tempered, and most often angered if things weren't going his way. He is intolerant of surrender under any circumstances, and is the ultimate essence of bold force and strength. He is not so much the god of war as much he is the god of the commotion, confusion, and the horrors associated with war. Ares loves war for war's sake, and delights in the sounds of the battles, sound of the clashing swords, in the slaughter of innocent people, and the destruction of towns. He is worse than any nightmare imaginable. She shivered, realizing for the first time that that's who she had been for the past several seasons, and she didn't want to do it anymore. As the encampment grew closer and closer, she could see the campfires glowing in the distant shadows like the summertime lightning bugs on a black fabric. As they flickered, she felt an ominous feeling of doom deep in her stomach, turning and flopping like freshly caught fish. She could feel the energy sparks fill the air, its fiery energy surrounding her, causing the hair on the back of her neck to stand straight on end, and the pit in her stomach tighten even more around her bowels. It was him.
And just where the Hades have you been?
His voice bellowed, echoing in her ears like the sounds of a thunderstorm. I needed to take a walk to clear my head. It was a long and hard battle, and I lost a lot of good men today. For no reason. She bellowed back. I deserve some time to myself. Turning to walk away from him, she hoped he didn't see the flower in her hand, or sense the change in her voice. Even she knew it was different. She just wasn't sure how or why. But she could feel something inside was different, and she wasn't prepared for him to see it. Hades. She didn't even know what it was, let alone to try and hide it from him. Is there a problem with that? She took a quick glance at the delicate flower in her hand, and curled her fingers slightly to protect it from being damaged. This flower was a sign, and she had every intention of protecting it from Ares. There was something magical about this flower, and her heart felt it was like the key to her future. She turned her back to him, so he couldn't see her slip the rose into her tunic, into the space between her breasts. As she slid the rose out of danger, a loose petal fell to the ground, Ares' eyes following it as it slipped unnoticed to the ground. Sensing something out of place within the warrior, Ares stared at her back, summing up every inch of the warrior. Her stance was solid, her head held high, her rippling arms glistening in the flickering light of the campfire, and yet he knew something was out of sorts.
What are you hiding from me? I can tell there is something different about you. What are you hiding?
He stood large and crossed his arms over his chest, his hands clenched in tight fists, ready to swing into action at the slightest provocation. He knew she could move like lightning if she felt threatened, and he wanted to make sure he was able to get the first swing in, especially since he couldn't see her face and judge her thoughts. He wasn't taking any chances.
I'm tired,
was all she could muster. She still had the pounding headache, and had not gotten any better, although it was now hidden behind the memory of a child and those eyes. She needed to sleep, to enter Morpheus's realm and dream. She needed to reconnect with those feelings and determine if what she was feeling was real. But she had to refocus all of her attention on the god of war so that he wouldn't be able to see or pick up on the change of heart she was having. She focused on one of the campfires off in the distance and repeated, "I am tired. I'm going to my tent, fix a tea to cure this damn pounding in my head, and sleep. Tomorrow I shall reevaluate our battle strategy and move on to the next town." She turned to face Ares, and her chin met with a fist of steel, catching her off balance and throwing her into a complete spin. As she regained her composure, she was again challenged with a fist, this time from the left that connected to her right eye. Her eye exploded into a spray of blood. She could barely see through the bloodied veil and tried to cover her face just long enough to think her way through this. She knew that he was pissed, and that she was now fighting for her life. Maybe she was an oracle after all. She did say earlier that the next battle would end her suffering. Hopefully, it wouldn't kill her. Chapter 3. She was able to regain control, wipe the blood from her eye, and blindly swing out to backhand Ares, splitting his lip and filling his mouth with crimson spittle, the taste of blood igniting a rage within him. He took on a new need, to kill the warrior princess. He swirled and then spit, the blood settling on a fallen leaf, his nostrils flaring like a bull arming to charge, and his eyes widened in open disbelief. "Looks like we have a problem now, doesn't it?" he stated very coldly. He swung out, only to be met with the back of her hand. She was fighting for her life, and any mistake she made, he would take advantage of. She knew it was real. Wrist to wrist, hand to hand, the battle was on. Ares combined a left and a right to try and catch her off guard. Each throw was met with an open hand. The silvery clashing sounds of metal wristbands to wristbands echoing in the darkness, making the battle sound worse than it was. She kicked out with her leg, meeting his groin, sending him face first into the dirt, a shattering, ear-splitting scream escaping from deep within his throat. Score one for the warrior princess. Breathlessly, she slowly bent down so that she could whisper in his ear, "No problem. Not today. Not now. And not in the future. I am done. You." She took in a deep breath. "I'm not doing this any more." Catching a breath, she was able to cut that one last dig into his soul. "I'm dedicating my life to Athena and have asked for her patronage. I'm yours. No more!" she exclaimed with an indignant strength in her voice. "I will follow you. No more!" Ares remained bent in an attempt to protect his jewels. For an internal moment, his nuts were in his throat. When he was able to regain some scent of dignity, he looked up, and with that sarcastic guard of war smile raiding across his face, he said with a dry, mocking tone, "I am the one who ends it. And if I end it, Hades will be picking you up in pieces," he said coldly. You are not leaving as easily as that. Mark my words, my warrior princess. You will regret crossing me. Someday I will make you pay. Remember this. You will know what it's like to lose that one thing in your life that means more to you than life itself. That one thing that keeps you going." Instantly, he was standing in front of her, thrusting his hands into her midsection, fast and fierce, and then, with a flash of lightning, he was at her throat, twisting until she couldn't breathe. He slowly stood, still holding her throat in his hand. Gasping for breath and with one last burst of strength, she swung herself into him and rolled free to the ground, heaving and throwing up. He stood back and watched over her, arms crossed over his chest, smiling. Ares couldn't help but gloat. Just enough personal satisfaction to throw his ego into dropping his shield for a mere moment. In a single move, she was able to jump up, twirl, and land behind him before he had a chance to react. With a quick and decisive kick, she had him on his knees. She reached down to rip his head off his shoulders, not noticing that her shadows were flickering upon the trees, warning him of her next move. In the wink of an eye, he extended his hand behind his head. Grabbing her hand, he threw her over his head, sending her into the darkness. Crash! As a warrior princess met with breaking branches. She stood and shook herself off, surveying the area. She jumped up into a tree to get a better view of the area. It was dark in the trees, but she could clearly see the terrain in the campfire light. Taking quick stock of the surroundings, she threw her chakram at the heavy tree branched, poised above Ares' head. The creaking and breaking of sounds of splitting wood forced him to look up. As a branch smashed into Ares' head, she holstered the returning chakram and jumped back into the fight. Ares exploded from the pile of debris with shards of fire aimlessly flying through the air. In an instant, he had a sword drawn, ready to slice her head off. Sensing the danger and hearing the air split as the sharp blade cut through it, she was able to stop the oncoming blade between her hands and, with a push, forced the hilt back into his chest. She stood and drew her sword from its hidden sheath on her back. Bang! Swish! Swish! As the blades cut through a gash through the air, making whistling sounds. Swish, swish, clang, chang. Noises of the fight rang throughout the valley, echoing louder and louder, warning others to stay away. Clang, clank. The flat sides of the blades slamming into each other, making inhuman noises that echoed throughout the forest, their savage strength vibrating throughout time and space as metal collided into metal. Ares, loving the sounds of the fight, was slightly distracted as the warrior princess kicked his legs out from under him, knocking him to the ground. She sheathed her sword and reached for the nearest rock and slammed it into the side of his face. His head swung back, a new bruise and blood dripping down his temple. He fell against the side of the hill and slid to the ground, succumbing to the darkness. She stood over him, surveying the god of war, blood dripping onto his chest from his head, and she smiled. Ares' eyes popped open, and he rammed his left fist into her face as she bent over him. As she was flying away from him, he grabbed her by the ankle and flipped her over his head, banging her against the wall of the rock face again and again. The warrior reached out for a broken tree branch and swung it into the god's face, causing him to release her. She slammed into another tree, falling to the ground while the tree exploded into a heap of flying rubble and settling leaves. The warrior couldn't open her right eye at all, and could barely see out of her left. The campfire throwing unrecognizable shadows into the trees, while Ares continued to swing wildly, alternating between her head, face, and midsection. It seemed like hours later when he stopped thrusting his fist into her face. She fell to the ground, motionless, her face turning black and blue, her body contorting into an unrecognizable hump of flesh as she lay on the ground, now drenched in her own blood. He stomped the ground, and the warrior bounced into the air from the percussion. Before she could stand, he was able to knee her stomach over and over, walking her toward the trees. With one final hasty kick, she was draped over a branch, her face blackened, her face swollen, and arms dangling from her lifeless body. Slowly regaining consciousness and the strength to hold herself together, she attempted to free herself up by grabbing a branch, and, grimacing from the pain, she swung down to the ground, refusing to give him the satisfaction of dying while lying down. As he watched, she slowly stood, blood flowing from a cut above her eye, her lips split open, her face a rainbow shade of purple. Her head tilted to one side, her right arm dangling from her shoulder, bent at the elbow and held tight to her chest. She would die with dignity and on her feet. She slowly walked up to him, and with the final blow, he hit her squarely in the face, sending her flying backwards into a tree and knocking her out. Her body slumped to the ground and her spirit broken. The warrior princess was knocking on Hades' door. The battle was over. Ares watched as the rose fell out of its hiding place, his heart burning and seething with anger. He slowly stepped over the flower and crushed it, grinded into the dirt, breaking its magical hold on its beloved warrior princess. Speaking over her spiritless form, Ares boomed,
"You can't hide anything from me. You should have known this by now. I know your true heart."
Ares shook off all the injuries he had endured, and with a twist of his hand, he exploded out of existence, leaving behind the warrior princess to succumb to her injuries. In the void where he once stood, you could hear the echo of his last words.
Only I can say when you're done with me. And now, I am done with you. Now, I say, this is over.
The sergeant that had been watching the fight from the shadows turned his back on the shapeless form and walked down to the encampment to pass the word. The warrior princess was dead. From the buzzing stillness, a golden figure dressed in a white tunic with a golden rope, belt and crown of gold thorns on her head, stepped from the shadows, reaching down and scooped up the lifeless form. In the blink of an eye, they shimmered out of sight, leaving an exaggerated illuminated golden outline fading into the darkness, leaving behind a mere scent of a wild rose. Chapter 4. Gia settled into an eerie silence as Athena picked up the motionless form and shimmered out of sight. The air stood still, no movement, no wind, no sound. Gia was in mourning. The warrior princess's trusted sergeant, Atreus, had been hiding into the shadows, watching the fight with reluctance. He would have died for her, except that no one wins against the god of war. He cannot die, no matter how much he appears to be injured. Atreus knew that no matter how much the warrior princess fought against Ares, no matter how much pain she would inflict upon him, she could not and would not win. She was destined to lose this battle. If it hadn't been for the promise he made to the warrior princess, Atreus would have stepped in and sacrificed himself in her place. But, since he had made the promise to her, all he could do was trust the warrior princess knew what she was doing. He shook his head and started down the encampment. He had to trust that the warrior princess had a damn good reason for doing what she did. He figured he would find out in due time. He had faith in the warrior princess. But for the moment, he had the sad job of telling a personal guard that she was dead. Aerie materialized at the entrance of the Cave of Fates. The opening was overgrown with trees and branches, bushes and weeds, scarcely visible to any human. But since Ares is not human, he was able to easily bypass the undergrowth and venture into the cave. The cave was barely lit, except for the flicking essence from the hearth at the end of the cave. The stone fireplace built by Hephaestus himself was carved out of the side of the stone rock face of the cave, with a fire burning in its hearth. He was not in awe of the colossal, colorful canvases stretched from one end of the cave to the other, from ceiling to floor. He merely glanced at it with contempt, and walked into the middle of the room. The framed cloth consisted of multicolored threads, interwoven with gold and black coins into a beautiful but yet complicated tapestry, representing the entire length of a mortal man's existence. The loom stood in front of the tapestry, the heavy frame holding thousands of vertical threads, each held taut by hanging weights and intertwining with the horizontal threads, creating the complicated relationships of man. Sitting in front of the loom sat three absolutely stunningly beautiful women, the daughters of the goddess of necessity and divine law, known as the Fates. Clotho, the youngest, who spins the threads of man's life into the tapestry. Lachesis, the middle daughter, who selects the lot of man who will live and winds each thread into the bobbin of the shuttle, representing the length of each mortal man's life. And Atropos, bearer of the scissors and the eldest of the three daughters, who brings the inevitable end to man's life. Hanging off the bench, where Atropos sat, at one end of the loom, is a worn cloth bag, filled with black and gold wooden coins. When each man is born, Lachesis would reach into the bag and pull out a few coins that represent the lot in life that each mortal shall endure in his lifetime. These were then woven into the tapestry using the mortal's life thread. Periodically throughout a mortal's life, she would reach into the bag and pull out a coin, and it would be woven into the fabric, changing and altering the mortal trials and tribulations. Atropos was sitting alone at one end of the loom, her scissors periodically cutting threads. Clotho was winding multiple shuttles between the threads and coins, creating the wonderful tapestry.
"Well, well, well. Ladies of the light, how the Hades are you days? Aren't you looking especially sharp today?"
he said sarcastically. Each looked up from their task, but not stopping. Clotho started.
"Ares, we are not expecting you,"
finished Lachesis. The three sisters so profoundly in tune that talking to them was like talking to a single person. One would start a thought, and the others would periodically chime in and finish.
"What can stated Arthurbrus. We do for, Lachesis interrupted. You.
Clotho finished the thought.
Now, ladies, can't I just drop in and visit?
He stated with a joke in his voice. Clotho started.
Ares, we,
Lachesis finished.
Know better.
Ares snickered. I don't always come wanting something now, do I?
He asked with a chuckle. Lachesis started.
Ares, what?
Clotho sang in.
Is it?
Arthropos finished.
You aren't.
Getting down to the core of his visit.
I guess no small talk, eh? Well, okay. I came today because I need your help. I need to see Xena's life thread for yesterday.
Arthropos started.
She is dead. I cut her life thread yesterday night.
Clotho chimed in.
We cannot change what has already happened.
Finished Lachesis.
I don't want to change it. I just want to see that last day.
He pleaded.
Please.
Ares?
Clotho started.
You always try to get us.
Arthropos continued. Lachesis finished.
To make us change to a mortal's life.
With a smirk across his face, Ares continued.
Please. I know she is dead. I'm trying to see why, that's all. Please.
It was apparent to all that he was hiding something. He is the original bad boy. Arthropos watched him, trying to judge his true intentions. She placed her scissors into the pouch on her black dress and released a single thread, cut short earlier. Reaching out and grabbing a lonely single thread and placing it between a forefinger and thumb, a smoky vision appeared above the hearth. The vision appeared through the smoky haze. It showed yesterday's day in the life of the warrior princess, the last day of her life. The sun was high in the sky, and the warrior princess was finishing a talk with Atreus, the sergeant of her private guards.
Arry, warrior princess, I understand. I would do as you ask. Is there nothing I can say to change your mind?
He stated in his native Scottish accent. No, Atreus, there isn't. Please, a pounding in my head, like Nubian drums. I must find wormwood and some clover's root for a tea to numb this pain. Please allow me some time and peace alone to search. Keep the guard here. I need this time alone. She stated with a pleading undertone in her voice. She turned and headed to the woods. Ares watched as the afternoon played out in front of his eyes. He could see how she took a walk in the woods, found a barely visible path, set upon the rock, all seemingly innocent in itself, until she saw the object of his intense hate and anger. His eyes squinted and his blood pressure rose, causing his face to turn red and the hackles on the back of his neck to stand on end. That damned flower. He could see that this was the turning point of the warrior princess, and he knew that that was the beginning of the end for the life plan he had for her. He needed to find a way to go back and replay this day with a minor change of getting rid of that flower and that child. How was he going to talk to the fates into changing that was had already happened? And he knew it wasn't going to be easy, because he would have to do it under the nose of his father, Zeus. Pesky problem, but he knew he could figure it out. It was just going to be a very delicate task, because there was just one problem. He killed the warrior princess. The scene above his head played out in the end of her life. He saw that she lay in a heap, dead, because of him. He bowed and shook his head.
It wasn't supposed to go that way.
He turned to the three ladies.
Are you sure we can't work some magic and bring her back from Tartarus to finish a true path in life?
His voice actually cracking.
I can make it worth your time. Really?
He pleaded.
Like the embers of the fire. We can only change when there is still life in the embers. But we cannot add fire where there is no wood. We cannot change the path of one who has no future, or,
as they all sang together,
that which has already ended.
Lachesis finished.
Once the thread has been cut,
Arthropos started.
We cannot reconnect the thread,
Clotho stated.
We cannot give life,
stated Lachesis.
Where life is not,
Arthropos finished.
That is not it,
Clotho interjected.
Zeus's plan. We are merely,
Lachesis stated, speaking of Lottie,
the caretakers of his plan,
Arthropos stated, finishing the thought. Before all the whole show had played, Arthropos let go of the thread, laying it gently back in its place, not noticing the long strand that clung to the end of the thread. He visually memorized the location of the end of the thread. surveying the cave for something within immediate reach that he could slip into the location unnoticed. He spotted a piece of a twig and reached down and picked it up, casually stuck it in the corner of his mouth. He then walked up to the tapestry and ran his hands along the surface, stopping at the site where Xena's life thread ended.
Is there nothing I can trade? Maybe a day where I do your jobs and you get to go outside and spend the day in the sun. I know you would like that,
he said, trying to distract them from their task. With the second piece that he had picked up at the same time he picked up the one in his mouth, he managed to nonchalantly slip it in at the side at the end of the thread.
No, Ares, we cannot leave our post,
stated Clothos.
Okay, fine. Thank you, ladies, for your lack of enthusiasm for my dilemma,
Ares stated with an unspoken contemplation.
I appreciate the replay. I will tackle this another way. I need to take care of some business. So thank you again,
he said, and with a twist of his hand, he was gone. They all looked at each other and nodded in unison. They knew he would be back. They returned to their tapestry and continued on with their work. Chapter 5 Athena rematerialized outside of a little wooden house in the mountains. The ground was covered with snow, and there were animal furs of wolf, bear, beaver, and red fox hanging from the porch rafters. Firewood, cut out and piled on the porch, stood strung against the wind and blowing snow. She stepped up to the porch and observed the symbol above the door, a staff with snakes entwined on the top to meet a pair of wings. Using her foot, she gently knocked on the door. A silent bearded man, silhouetted by the light of the fire of the fireplace, opened the door, his body completely blocking any entrance into the house. Athena held the limp body of the warrior princess in her arms.
Asclepius, please, Athena said in an excited but smooth, even tone. Her wounds were too great for me to heal. Please, the warrior princess is,
she stated with a stammer.
I,
her voice choking up. He reached out and took the lifeless form from Athena's grasp, turned and walked back inside. Athena started to enter behind him, but the door shut before she could enter. Cocking one eyebrow, she took the hint and glistened out of sight. Walking over to the feather bed by the fire, Asclepius laid the lifeless form in the middle and proceeded to remove her clothing.
Get my bag,
he commanded to his assistant, pronouncing each syllable slowly and with confidence. He sat on the small stool that sat next to the bed. His assistant left the room and returned with a small wooden bag and handed it to the medicine bag.
Get me a bin of hot water and a fresh cloth.
He reached into the bag and took out a small satchel filled with a powder. He sprinkled the dust over a few of the more demanding wounds. His assistant ran off to the hearth and removed the steamy water from the fire and poured it into a ceramic bowl that was marked with the same symbol as that the outside the door. She laid it to the floor next to the healer and ran off to get clean cloth. After taking off her bloody and torn tunic, he gently laid a clean cloth across her breast and groin. Her skin had turned white. Blood flow slowed to a near stop. Her black hair crusted with dry brown blood and twigs and leaves. Her left arm dangled off the side of the bed, and her right lay across her chest. The healer gently reached over and pulled her arm in and laid it at her side. He had his assistant wash off the blood and dried forest from her body. He gently washed each cut, each bruise, each part of her body.
Be careful cleaning her. Gently clean and cleanse, please. There is a fire. There are embers still burning here. She is not dead yet. We must hurry,
he told her matter-of-factly. He gently laid his hands over her heart, about an inch above her skin, and ran them down the full length of her left side of her body. When he reached her feet, he stopped and ran them up the other side of the warrior's body until he reached her head. He ran his hands through this pattern several times and finishing where he started. He stood and walked over to a shelf, reached up, and took a little blue bottle from the back. He walked back to the warrior's body and gently opened the bottle. Pouring a small amount into his hands, he rubbed the lotion into the skins of his palm. He went back to the bed where the warrior princess lay and stood over her, placing his hands over her heart. Again, he ran his hand along the length of her body, only this time, small blue and white electrical sparks were seen shooting from the palms of his hands and into the warrior's skin. When he completed two rounds of her body, he came to rest above her heart. With his eyes closed, he started again.
walking about her body, and blue sparks again emitting from his hands and into the warrior's body beneath his hands. He continued to do this several times until, finally, he took the forefinger of his left hand and gently touched her heart. Her body shook and convulsed. She gasped for breath. Her eyes snapped open, and her body relaxed and then sunk into the feather bed. Chapter 6.
Dear old dad, how the Zeus are ya?
Popped in a buoyant Ares. Zeus, opening his eyes and looking up from his chest, retorted,
Well, Ares, to what do I owe this especially pompous visit?
His voice booming like rolling thunder in a clear day, echoing off the white limestone walls of Mount Olympus.
Now, Pops,
the mischief of a toddler reflected in his voice.
Can't I just pop in?
Zeus looked at him, cocked his head to contemplate that comment for a moment.
Ares, you have never just popped in anywhere.
He stood from his great white and gold throne and walked down the white limestone steps to where Ares stood before him.
What's really on your mind?
Okay. But I ask that you be open-minded in my request, okay?
He pleaded as Zeus directed him to the balcony. When they reached the balcony, Zeus led him to the banister, and they both leaned against a railing, looking over the edge down to the lands of the mortals. As they both looked down, all they could see was a green plush land of Greece, laid out before them, with the jade and bluish-green waters of the Mediterranean and Aegean seas surrounding the breathtaking landscape.
Zeus. Father. Zeus. I'm not in the mood to barter with you. I'm not in the mood to give in to your ways. I need this favor.
He pleaded with his father.
I killed my warrior princess. She pissed me off and I didn't see beyond my anger to see the fact that I need her to carry out my plans with the Romans. I've been building her up for several years and in the heat of anger, well, we got in a fight and, well, now she is dead.
Zeus listened intently, not interrupting Ares' story in amazement that he actually was taking responsibility for his own actions. Or was this a ploy?
I come to you to ask that I be granted my favor. You grant each of your children a favor, and I have never come to you before, and I come now to you asking for mine. You know what my request is. Please don't make me say it.
He said, not looking at Zeus or his reaction to his request, but rather at his feet like a little boy caught in a lie by his dad. Finally, after several awkward moments, Ares looked at Zeus to get his reaction out of him.
Zeus?
Questioned Ares. Zeus stood and looked Ares in the eye.
Have you visited the Fates? What say they?
The fabled brush off.
Thought Ares. Taking a deep breath, Ares bullied.
Zeus, you know very well what they said. They cannot go against your plan and bring back to life any mortals whose life thread has been cut.
Yes, this is true. What you ask, I have forbidden. I cannot change what is cast.
He said, dashing Ares' hope of bringing back the warrior princess.
Ares, I cannot bring any mortal back from the dead. No mortal shall ever rise from the dead in our time. It would bring about the destruction of Mount Olympus, all Olympians, and the world as we know it. My father, Cronus, foretold of a time when a mortal who had died shall recross the land of the living, and then this mortal shall bring about the end of the world. As we know it.
He said, still looking over the banister, his hands grasping onto the rail.
Ares, the oracles have foretold of a mortal who would bring down the reign of the Olympians, and that includes you. You would be no more. You would have no more influence over mortals than a single grain of sand clogging a mighty river. I must protect our power over mortals and direct them. I am their protector, as well as the protector of Olympians.
He continued.
I am sorry, Ares. I cannot allow this. But maybe I can give you something in exchange. What exactly is it that the warrior princess can do that no one else can?
He asked point blank. Boasting, Ares started to describe what he most liked about his warrior princess.
She commands from the heart,
he stated, vigorously pounding his fist over his heart.
She is evil to the core, and in battle, she can make blood fly farther than anyone.
Sounding like a proud father describing his own child.
She can beat the best of men in any hand-to-hand combat. She can win them over by the mere sound of her voice. The strongest men in the world cannot look into her eyes without feigning. I've been molding her into the most beautiful war machine, and I need her in order to win against the Romans. And she's beautiful to boot.
Zeus cut him off.
Ares, what you ask I cannot grant you. There is no way I'm going to allow a mortal to return to the living and end the rule of the Olympians here on Mount Olympus. I cannot allow it.
He thundered, lightning flashing in his crystal blue eyes. Ares knew he meant business. Taking a deep breath and speaking in a softer voice, Zeus started again.
But I can give you another to take her place, who will be as devoted to you as she was.
Kicking the ground, Ares knew he had been beat.
Very well,
he said with reluctance.
Go to the land of Thessaly, to the city of Dion, and you will find a woman there who will be your new warrior princess. You will know her when you see her. She is someone you already know.
Zeus concluded.
Oh, crap, thought Ares. I hope it's someone I actually like.
Ares left Mount Olympus and rematerialized in the market square in the city of Dion. He didn't think he would be very welcome, so he thought it best to stay hidden by disguise, and yet remain in total view, so he could check out all of the women in the square. If he knew her, then she knew him, and he wanted to know who it was first, so he could object if he needed to, although he was pretty sure Zeus wouldn't change his mind about Xena. So basically, he was stuck with whoever this was, or at least until he could figure out a way to go back in time and save the warrior princess from himself. Looking around at the faces in the market square, he saw no one that he recognized. He wandered around the square, periodically looking at a ware or two and putting it back, his disguise successfully blocking his true identity for the merchants. He was not very happy having to walk amongst these mortals without killing a few. If they only knew just who it was they were degrading, they would be bowing to him, instead of yelling at him and pestering him to buy something.
How rude and how inconsiderate these mortals are,
he thought to himself. He had already wandered around town for several candle marks and still had no idea who this woman could be, even after going through every woman he could think of. Anger growing in his heart and his head filling itself with self-indulgent crap, he was talking himself right into a tizzy. This woman had better show up soon. The darkness was encroaching on the town, and still no face to recognize. It was getting late, and he needed to rest. It had been a long, hard last couple of days, and needed to recoup. With a twist of his hand, nothing remained except the faint outline of where he once stood. As the last of the shimmering essence of Ares disappeared, a dirty blonde-haired woman came around the corner. As she walked through the very spot he once stood, she stopped and looked around, sensing he was near. Still, she said nothing. Looking to the direction of the setting sun, she decided not to call his name. She wanted to be fresh when she caught up with him. When Zeus rescued her, he made it very clear that they were to work together, regardless of their past or future experiences. She headed to the nearest Terran and got a room for the night. She would call Ares tomorrow. She wanted to make sure she was rested when she encountered him. The next morning, the birds were singing in Apollo's ride across the sky when the new warrior princess woke. With barely a movement of her hand and a flash of a twig, the bird was falling to the ground, dead. She hadn't stayed in the dark for all that time, only to come to the light, having to hear that first thing in the morning. Settling into breakfast, she stayed in the corner of the tavern, so that the shadows provided some protection from the watchful eye of the tavern keeper and his wife. She didn't want any unnecessary questions. She wasn't in the mood for them. It was the first time in many, many moons that she had slept in a bed, and she hadn't slept very well. Coming back a few years to be with Ares as his new warrior princess was better than dying in that cave he had originally left her in. But first, she had to live up to a bargain with Zeus. If she wanted her freedom and revenge, she would have to first do it Zeus's way. Walking out to the market, the new warrior princess looked around, and upon not seeing Ares, she headed off to a quiet alley.
Ares!
She yelled, looking up and around.
Ares! You slimy buckeye! Where are you?
She yelled with indignation.
Where the Hades are you?
She yelled to the wind.
Zeus told me to call you. Ares!
A shimmer of an essence started to materialize, taking shape before her eyes. Ares stood with his arms crossed over his chest, his black leather vest highlighting his biceps. She watched intensely as his pectoral muscles bulged and pulsated under the closed clasp of his vest. His black leather-tight pants around his midsection, she took a great gasp. She forgot how handsome he was.
Who are you to be calling me?
He raged. Regaining control and remembering her goals, she took a step up to him, and with sheer hatred in the tone of her voice, she stated clearly,
"I am your new warrior princess."
He stepped back and disappeared, leaving her standing there with no explanation and her mouth wide open. To be continued.
Well, that concludes 124th episode of XNU, and that is part 2, 3, and 4, and I think possibly 5 of the storyline that I'm doing for Denny, and it is You Can't Tame a Wild Rose. I hope everyone is enjoying that. If you have any questions or suggestions on the show, please send me an email at xena.uber@gmail.com. I will also forward them on to Denny so that you can give her positive feedback or critique on the storyline. I also need and request, if you have any recipes, send them on in so I can update the Traveling Bard Recipes Corner. Once again, thank you to everybody who has donated. Please take a look and have a looky and donate if you can have the opportunity and have the money to go ahead and kindness in your heart. Go ahead and just give $5, $10 for that so that we can reach our goal. Also, for any future story suggestions, please send me an email with them. I need a couple of more stories coming in, guys, because pickings are slim and I haven't heard back from a lot of the authors. So send me an email, xena.uber@gmail.com. So until the next episode, everyone, take care, enjoy life and love. Bye-bye. Pray for salvation, pray that we rise, pray.